Mo P. Diddy money, Mo P. Diddy problems. In honor of Bad Boys for Life, what other P. Diddy song should become a movie?
I'm Katie Rich, and I'm going with It's All About the Benjamins, which is about the blood feud between Ben Burtt, the voice of R2-D2, and Ben Platt, that kid from The Politician. I don't know why. There's a blood feud.
Just made it the whitest version of that. I'm Matt Patches, and I'm going to go with I'll Be Missing You, that little remix of the Police song, Every Breath You Take. But I'm imagining the movie. I really want a movie about how Sting and Sean Combs decided to sing that song together at the 1997 MTV Video Music Awards, which may also be the whitest version of that movie. Whoops.
Hey, I'm David the Seven. I'm going to go with Come With Me, the song from the Godzilla 1998 soundtrack. But the movie shouldn't be about Godzilla, but it's like a Scarface tale where he's himself as like a rapper rising to prominence and then killing a bunch of people with a machine gun.
I'm David Ehrlich. I have two. The first is, of course, Diddy Speaks off the 1999 album Forever, which in my mind would be a Spalding Gray-like monologue film where Diddy would just speak directly to the camera about his experience working on the film Godzilla, but also working on screen in the film Get Him to the Greek. Great performance, decent film. Forgetting Sarah Marshall deserved a better follow-up. That's neither here nor there. And my other one, of course, is We Dem Boys off of Rap Game Volume 1, which I just misread as We Dern Boys. And, of course, that film would be about Laura Dern taking in a baseball team worth of orphans and having to train them to win the local Little League championships.
That's just Little Men, the sequel, right?
Yes.
Subtitle, We Dern Boys.
Gentlemen, you can't fight in here. This is the war room.
Fine, I can hear you now, Dimitri. Clear and plain and coming through fine. I'm coming through fine too, eh? Good, then. Well, then, as you say, we're both coming through fine. Good. Well, it's good that you're fine and I'm fine. I agree with you. It's great to be fine.
It's a podcast.
Hello and welcome to Fighting in the War Room. It's episode 284. It's the week of Wednesday, January 15th, 2020. Happy New Year, everybody. I mean, I know Dave and Patches. First of all, that was the day in 1975 that Space Mountain opened at Disneyland. Woo. I was going to say it seems cold, but it's in California. Happy New Year. I hope everybody enjoyed the Dave and Patches conspiracy theory hour as much as I did. I know it was more than conspiracy theories, but that was where you guys really found a groove.
I see. That's where it shined versus our deepest, darkest secrets about male toxicity.
It really was an episode of you asking Dave questions that I would have been annoyed by and refused to answer. And Dave goes, let me think about that. And that was why the episode
worked.
Why
would you have been annoyed by them?
Because I would have been like, I don't fucking know. Leave me alone. And Dave,
what's the biggest lie you've ever told?
I will say I enjoyed the unstructured quality of the episode. I know our podcast has been appreciated for having a more structured nature than a lot of other movie podcasts, and so I can't really fight against that. But
we could get more gonzo in our structure.
Just go nuts every once in a while.
You know, our segments don't need to feel chained down by what the man tells us to talk about.
I'm not sure they ever have.
By the way, the notes in our doc left over from 2019 says, give us the funky Winkerbean verse, including a crankshaft Dizzy Plus series. So I'm feeling like we should bring that energy to the podcast in 2020.
I somehow assigned you that as a task in Google Docs. I got to get on that. I'm never undoing it.
Dave, get Kevin Feige on the phone.
It's not my task.
Right now.
David's on. Welcome, hey, David.
Hell yeah, David. You're back.
How's your baby?
Baby's good. Good babies. On our Patreon feed, you can hear the episode where I say, never have a child. They will ruin your life, desecrate your soul. We don't have a Patreon, do we? No, babies are good. I am still struggling to understand how anyone manages to have one and continue about their business in this world, but hopefully I'll figure it out. And that is, I say that as someone who is blessed to have a partner who can help me. I certainly cannot even begin to fathom how anyone does this on their own. But
the good thing,
it's a good thing my son is so damn cute.
They can take care of themselves soon. And do
soon, things. But not right now. He's still in the
My daughter just turned two, and I made her take out trash.
I mean, that's incredible.
She can carry cardboard.
My son is still in the place where if I left him on the couch and walked away, he would just shrivel and die.
Well, now you don't have to buy paperweights anymore.
That few survival instincts right now. So he would cry a lot first, I'm sure. But so far, net positive on children.
Hey, it's 2020, baby. We're having a good time on the podcast.
You enjoy doing the afterlife. At least you have some comfort there, right? Unless you guys went to different places, which is very likely at this point, I think.
What's happening?
Do you think I can call my daughter in heaven from hell?
Nope.
Patches really got empowered by all your positive feedback from last week's episode, so please keep it all back.
We have reviews. We have reviews. And David's going to read a few of them now that he's back on the podcast. We're really happy, David, that you are back. I know that you have to cut into your kid time to be here, or at least cut into the hours where you should be sleeping.
I hope he's asleep.
No, he is not asleep right now. We're recording. It's 9:20. He does not have any sort of regular sleeping time at this point. It is still utter chaos.
He's the Joker.
It's not really
soon to be nominated.
Putting into my time so much as I don't really know how people, how you and Katie have been able to do it reliably. Because at least at this point, and I told that this will change, and eventually will soon have a reliable sleeping time. But right now, it's just like there's just no way to predict if he's going to be asleep. There's no way to really arrange a recording time when you can guarantee.
If you remember, I took a full 3
David
months
does not remember
both times I had a newborn. So yeah,
David does not remember when we were doing the podcast and had small children.
Well, the thing about having a child is that you immediately forget everything that has ever happened to you prior to.
This is correct. This is absolutely true. And today I saw a real baby and I was like, I don't even remember my kid at that age. Like, all time has no meaning.
Yeah. No,
speaking of which, reviews, because we're eating up time on this podcast that should have a limited amount of time.
We have reviews. I'm trying not to get distracted by people in my mentions saying that 1917 eliminated any digitally eliminated any visible edits and therefore should be considered for best editing. You guys are all fucking crazy. Okay, yeah, we do have some reviews. The first one is from Green Team, who says 2020 vision gives us 5 happy stars. Happy New Year to our hosts and fellow listeners. My resolution is to see more quality films in the theater and not just Disney Corporation blockbusters. Hear, hear, Green Team. This podcast keeps me alert while driving a patrol car at work, and I enjoy the variety of topics from pop culture ephemera to galaxy brain theory. So wait, please follow up if you can somehow about what kind of patrol car it is that you're driving. A law enforcement listening to Fighting in the War Room as they police our streets? Are you
mildly terrifying?
Are they green teens? Do they hire them as cops? I guess so. I will dispense with buttering up individual hosts who are all terrific. However, with love, I wish Patches would listen better when his co-hosts are trying to rein in his lunacy. Now, if it's any consolation, Patches, Green Teen, who is now one of my favorite listeners to this podcast, did misspell rain. They spelled it as into rule and not into pull a rein. So if that makes you feel any better about this devastating criticism you're getting, that's fine. I was just watching a Sex and the City episode, season 1 or something, where Carrie is getting like very up in her head about what's her face, Big's ex, and then she writes a card and misspells there, and now she feels good about it. You guys know what I'm talking about. Thank you all for your recommendations. As I write this, I'm catching up on The Crown. Yeah. Well, I know your plates are all full. In return, I would suggest giving Genndy Tartakovsky's Primal a look, as it is a unique, epic 2D animated series with no dialogue that challenges a viewer to put down their phones and pay attention.
I want to just pop in here for 1 second.
Sure.
Since I've been criticized.
You've been slammed.
I've watched Genndy Tartakovsky's Primal. It's fantastic.
Did you say Genndy?
It's Genndy.
Wow.
I think it might be Genndy. I don't know. I mispronounce things as I have a reputation here. But I want to say that I watched all of Primal. I loved it. I'd love to talk about it, but fuck off, Green Teen.
Wow.
Come on now. Don't come at me like this. Don't come at me at the beginning of the year telling me I'm lunatic. I'm a lunacy. I don't need
Green
to be reined in.
I just want to let you know that 3/4 of the podcast have your back. We support you in all that you do, and we hope that you have a wonderful 2020.
I can't be stopped.
And please continue destroying my patches from within. This review was very helpful.
When I come into the tidbit segment, can you introduce me as Joker?
Oh, no. You know what the good guy in every movie says? I can't be stopped.
Finally, we have another very adroit listener named RocococoR, who says, more David, please. This is what happens when you go away for 6 weeks. People, hopefully, you give them a chance to miss you. I thought it would take people a lot longer than that to have any any room for me to come back, but at least one person is happy I'm here. Katie, Dave, and Patches are great. Patches is okay, in parentheses.
Wait, what? What is the going on here? What have I done?
The karma. Reason I live in is karma. But the reason I listen to the show is that guy, David Ehrlich. What a
what
presence.
The hell?
I kind of feel like whoever this is taking the piss, but I'll let it happen. What a presence in my ears, his gentle disparagement and sarcastic barbs. I long for the chilling crackle of his echoey cell phone mic as he mercifully derails a suffocating Patches monologue. I look for David's analysis on any film I intend to view, and I find more often than not that we share opinions. Thank you, David, for your excellent work. P.S. I'm mostly joking about Patches. Sometimes he'll really hit the nail on the head, while others seem to miss the take, in parentheses, read abducted in plain sight. PPS, I forget which episode you discussed this, but I think the proper name for fans of this podcast should be Warheads. Just a suggestion, hashtag Green Teen Rules, Green Teen 2020. this review, very helpful, gives us a campaign slogan for 2020. And finally, we have Seth Charles, who says, podcast almost as good as the movie Foxcatcher 2015, 5 stars. We're not going to read this review. We're running short on time. But thank you for reading, for listening. Great film and TV discussions. Enjoy all the different perspectives and especially the differing opinions. Was following David Ehrlich on Twitter for about a year and never heard anything about this and started following Patty for a week. And saw a post about it and was in from the start.
Oh my
God. I do wish that sometimes they would clean up the audio as it does feel rushed and hark, Triton, hark. Bellow, bid our father, the Sea King, rise from the depths, full foul in his fury, black waves teeming with salt foam, to smother this young mouth with pungent slime, to choke ye, engorging your organs, till you turn blue and bloated with bilge and brine and can scream no more. Only when he, crowned in cockle shells, with slithering tentacle tail and steaming beard, take up his fell bee-finned arm, his coral-tine trident screeches banshee-like in the tempest and plunges right through your gullet, bursting ye, a bulging bladder no more, but a busted bloody film now, and nothing for the harpies, film by the way, and nothing for the harpies and the souls of dead sailors to peck and claw and feed upon, only to be lapped up and swallowed by the infinite waters of the dread emperor himself, forgotten to any man, to any time, forgotten to any god or devil, forgotten even to the sea, for any stuff, for part of Winslow, even any scantling of your soul is Winslow no more, but is now itself the sea. But overall, great podcast, huge recommend, misspelled. Was this review helpful? I do want to report a concern, but I'd say net helpful. As always, Seth Charles reminds us all, we will, for better or worse, read Ron Burgundy style anything that you will happen to leave in a review for us on iTunes at Fighting in the War Room.
That was an impressive cold read, David. You really just like went through that.
I'm not going to forget the part where he called you out for never tweeting about the show.
And
I'm going to be watching in 2020. My lunacy.
Leave us reviews. We're back, 2020. It's all happening. It's
all happening. We're gonna catch up with like the last month of things that we've been watching over our Christmas vacations. There was a time in my life when I would have used this time to catch up on things.
Holiday.
But
vacations.
I didn't, because I've been watching PJ Masks, which is the children's show that has entered my life most recently. And it's fine.
Wait, what
but,
is
you
that?
Know,
what is it?
It's on Netflix. It's like, it's based on a French series of books, which I learned very recently. It's like kids who at night they dress up as superheroes and like fight their like,
wait,
kids,
say the name of the
villains.
Show again.
PJ Masks.
PJ and Masks.
Like PJ, PJ, right. And Masks. Yeah. So, and in French, it's like a pun. It's like pyjamasks, I guess, like pajamas and masks. But so the English translation is kind of dumb. Anyway, PJ Masks is one thing I've been watching. The other thing is The Mandalorian. I can't remember how much we talked about it in the beginning.
Enough,
I feel like
I'm
we maybe
sure.
only talked about the first episode. I don't know, like in a very busy time for me in which like I was having a hard time finding time to watch anything, much less the movies that I was trying to catch up on. The Mandalorian was this very like reliable thing to come back to every week to be like, okay, here's 40 minutes of a show that I find enjoyable and entertaining and like feel something for the characters, mostly Baby Yoda, and then kind of move on from and catch up with the other week with the next week. And I think a lot of people felt that way about it. And to me, that felt like a really rousing success for The Mandalorian. I'm both excited to see a second season, and also I could never watch it again, and either would be fine. But I felt really glad that I watched The Mandalorian. Where'd you guys land on it? We have not talked about it since the first episode, right?
No, when David had one of the worst takes of the year, which is half an hour dramas. Ugh.
Yeah, that's true. That is one of the worst takes of the year.
Why? Of the whole year? From the all corners of the internet?
The whole year.
Oh, yeah.
Absolutely. In a year full of just too many shows and too many things to watch to complain, one, about a franchise that you don't really care that much about, and two, to get only 30 minutes when 30 minutes is such a pleasure in this case, like watching it on the train in my new commute. Like, it was the perfect amount of time that I wanted to spend in like whatever adventure they were going on that week, or whatever tiny conflict, or whatever mini movie they were putting on. The heist episode was so fantastic, and it's exactly how much time I wanted to spend trudging through that world.
Yeah, and I also should note, I still have not seen Rise of Skywalker. Like, it did nothing to me to like inflame a love of Star Wars or desire to wade into all of that. But that also felt fine to me.
It would actually probably undercut your experience, because I'm pretty sure the day before Rise of Skywalker came out, The Mandalorian had its episode where Baby Yoda used force healing, and then Rey did it later. It's like, even the most impressive things in Rise of Skywalker were undermined by the release of Mandalorian, and that's kind of funny.
Star Wars spoilers.
Minor Star Wars.
Well, I'm still playing Star Wars Galaxy of Heroes on my iPhone, a stupid fucking game that I've been addicted to for like 10 months.
Does it have Rise of Skywalker edition?
It's not.
Now?
I know it did. They did introduce a new version of Finn, like a second version, who reflects his status in Rise of Skywalker.
Mm. Not cool enough.
No, my galactic power, for anyone out there who's keeping score, is now 2,248,599. Not too shabby. But yeah. So. Sorry, Katie. Sorry to talk over you in the first episode of the season, but I did want to talk about Star Wars games on the subject. I beat Jedi Fallen Order. It was fine.
David, did you finish The Mandalorian?
Yes.
What was better?
Yeah,
or the show?
They are hard to compare. The Fallen Order game was well. I mean, like, Jedi combat was fun, but I think the game had a lot of really glaring design flaws. Mandalorian, sort of the opposite problem, where the design was admirable, but the whole concept I think didn't really push through to its best potential. Well, but it was okay. I never really cared about anything that was going on.
What was the color of your lightsaber in Jedi Order? Don't you get to choose?
Yeah, I think I was, but like, you have red and blue to choose from for most of the game. I'd imagine you can unlock another color at some point. But one of my big frustrations, of the game is that the only rewards you get for doing side quests or like chasing down treasure chests are like decals and like new looks for this and that. It's nothing substantive. And eventually I just like really stopped caring. So I have no fucking idea what kind of other light color,
perk.
But I will say there is an action sequence towards the end of the game that you are watching another character fight through a pane of glass, and it is so much cooler than anything that happens in Rise of Skywalker. It was just sort of a slap in the face. What a terrible, terrible, terrible movie that is.
Anyway. It's not good.
The other thing I thought of that I've watched since we last talked was Cats. Remember Cats?
It really came and went, which seems unfortunate.
Which is weird because of what a weird movie it is. And I don't like, I really wanted to be able to champion it as the way that some people have, as like this like true camp anomaly. It's a very weird movie, but it's also infuriatingly expensive and bad for what it is. But I've also had Skimbleshanks stuck in my head for a month now. So I don't know who's got the last laugh.
It's really disappointing to me that the movie seems to be fading out, or you can't really recommend a big budget disaster like this anymore, because it's in theaters and people don't want to spend $20 a ticket or something, or even $10 a ticket on something bad, right? It's not going to have a midnight movie moment.
Reasonable Matt Patches would end the conversation. It's been rejected by people who realize it was bad. That seems fine, right?
I know, but it just seems to have looped around to be so bad it's entertaining, and unfortunately it's not gonna get that moment in the sun.
Oh. If you're in a room with a bunch of drunk people who are your friends and they're like there to like really band together and make it fun, it can be that. But if you're just gonna go if you're gonna go to catch a screening, like the screening I saw was a press screening early, but it was still like not the vibe that you want to turn into something. And it felt like boring and disappointing. And I think that's probably why no one's going to see it.
Yeah, it's definitely the movie I've heard normal people talking about taking edibles more than any other experience. Like people I would not have expected saying, I loved being high and watching Cats. So there you go.
Are Colorado theaters where it's legal, like really playing into this?
I am unsure. What I do know is I think I'm one of two or three of my friends that are on this like group chat that hasn't seen Cats. And when one of them sees Cats, there's an onslaught of like in the 90s of Cats related jokes that are really feel exclusionary in their basis. I tried to get one of them to explain to me like use Jellicle in a sentence.
Jellicle.
See, there you go.
I'm sorry, wait. Can you say it the way you said it the first time again?
Jellicle?
Jealous.
You've never listened to Cats, huh?
I love that.
No, never listened to Cats, never seen Cats.
Wow.
Tried to get someone to explain Cats to me, and it was like, no, but then the movie's bad, and so I'm not going to go and see a bad version of Cats first.
Is there a good version of Cats?
I apparently not. I didn't know it was necessary to have seen it. As somebody in that group chat put, like, I always assumed it was a joke that people were like, I saw Cats, it was good, you should see Cats. Like, that's the joke. You see Cats and you're like, oh, I should reel other people into this.
I gotta say.
Carried over to the movies.
One of the
Cats,
first
the
things
music
I
in Cats is good.
My, one
the
of the first things I loved good. About my son, of many, is that he was born at a time that completely excused me from all Cats-related discourse. And I really, yep. really am angry at all of you right now for infringing on that wonderful gift that he gave to me.
David, so this is how I felt along, about Suicide Squad. Yeah. I still never seen Suicide Squad, didn't have to talk about it, doesn't exist.
But unfortunately for you, there will be out. A Suicide Squad 2. There will not be a Cats 2.
There's a spinoff coming out in 1 month.
Yep.
God, that's true.
Right, but it's not going to depend on her having ever watched Suicide Squad. I
probably
think Katie,
not.
You know, like David, I don't know. If the movie's
we're still
bad,
talking about Cats
it,
indirectly.
Yeah.
It's too close. Move bad. On.
Movie's bad. I watched some Netflix true crime documentaries outside of, you know, like catching up on movies that we've talked about before in our top 10 podcast and whatnot. But like for our semi-annual check in with Dave's weird true crime side obsession. I watched, what is it? Don't Fuck with Cats, which was interesting. Actually,
which has nothing to do with the movie Cats. It should be clear.
No, it has nothing to do with the movie Cats. But we should just talk about Don't Fuck with Cats. We don't have to spend time on the other Nazi hunting one, which is probably differently put together. And anyway, but Don't Fuck with Cats is a story about some people on the internet who find a video of a guy putting two cats in a vacuum sealer bag and sucking all the oxygen out of it till the cats are dead, and they decide to track him down because they think he's A, being mean to cats on the internet, and B, probably like a budding sociopath because he uploads more videos where he's like playing with the cat corpses, etc. This documentary takes place over 3 episodes on Netflix, and each one is about 50 minutes long. The first episode is about these internet crusaders who band together to find this person. They find him and realize that he could be dangerous because he's been killing all these animals and seems to be making many internet personas to cover for himself and make like a second life where he's this jet-setting playboy model. The second episode is when this person that they've already identified to the Toronto police graduates to killing a human and posting the video on the internet. And then, like, the police get involved. And the third video is about sort of the fallout of how this person, the third episode, about how this person, I don't know, rose to prominence on the internet. And his mom pops up to provide an alternate theory that he isn't like this guilty sociopath. It's an interesting true crime documentary, not only because is it a newer crime that is based around the internet, but because they fold that sort of into the filmmaking without like abandoning traditionally shot documentary elements. They'll do this thing, for example, when they're talking about locations all over the world, they'll use like a high definition capture of Google Earth and then capture their own 4K footage when they're in that town to interview people that sort of matches the angle. So the whole idea of smashing the showing people using the internet up against actual documentary footage really works. It sort of gets into like the best types of both of those David Fincher genres together. And they do this weird thing where every time they introduce a character from the internet group, they show them signing into Facebook and they have like different extensions of passwords. So there's like this guy, and it's like they go to the password field and you don't see how many what the actual password is, but you see how many characters it is. And because it's like 60 some characters, you're automatically, as a viewer, being like, this guy's very concerned with internet security. So it sort of provides this additional bit of information to the talking head. So I think it's well used and well edited as these documentaries go. I guess the weird thing about it was halfway through the second episode, I realized I had actually seen the video of the guy killing the guy online.
What?
At one point.
Why had you seen it, Dave?
Well, no, I've seen. So I was writing an article for Matt Patches, who worked for a website called Thrillist at the time, called "Most Disturbing Videos on the Internet." And instead of being smart and, you know, going out from instances that I knew about, my method was to find disturbing videos and then cut out the ones where it appeared like somebody actually died.
Yes, that was one of the rules. You weren't allowed to put actual death on my website. Thank you for not doing that.
But instead of, yeah, working from that edict out, I worked out to that edict, which found me watching a dude get stabbed with a
Jesus,
what looked like an ice pick. Anyway,
God,
it's good to know that if you want to find it, thanks. You could.
Yeah, well, now I know the whole story thanks to the Netflix documentary, and yeah, that's a thing I watched over vacation.
Boy, so as a cat lover and a cat's lover, should I be really watching this? This doesn't seem like I could stomach it.
I mean, it doesn't show the videos. It shows like parts of them, but it doesn't show anything graphic, I would say. But it is sort of interesting because the perpetrator does end up being like he's like learned serial killing sort of from movies. So there's a lot of twists that are like feel like they're out of a mystery novel because this guy's, you know, crazy and building his own serial killer mythology. Slowly on the internet.
I don't think I could stomach it.
Wow.
It's interesting.
Well, we're running long here, but my holiday viewing, we talked a little about it, I think, in the top 10 episodes.
I still have a segment to go, by the way. Me talking over Katie about Star Wars was not my go. I had six fucking weeks of sitting there and watching movies, Patches, so make it snappy.
That's true. David had more of a break than any of us.
Make it snappy.
Then please go. Well,
let you run out your time here.
You've steamrolled me here. I was going to just praise Uncut Gems. I was going to say that I haven't been watching a whole lot. As I told people on the last episode, I'm trying to really quit Twitter except for work-related purposes. So I funneled a lot of word-making energy into the New York Times crossword puzzle app, which is a new lifeblood for me in 2020.
It's a good choice.
And I think I mentioned this on the in our pre-recording chatter, but I'm playing Luigi's Mansion on the Switch, which is really creepy, actually. Has great soundtrack and amazing visuals that are terrifying. Luigi goes, "Oh, Mario!" so many times, and I get scared too. Like, it's really immersive in a way that I wasn't expecting a bubbly, cartoony Mario game or Luigi game to be. And
is it also like the haunted castles in the old Mario games?
Yeah, imagine, well, it's more like so the game is like ghost busting, right? You basically are walking around a mansion, or you're walking around a haunted hotel, sucking up ghosts and trying to save all your friends.
If you make a wrong turn, does Waluigi show up and scare you?
Waluigi has not shown up yet. I can only hope, but I haven't read about his involvement, and I'm pretty on top of my Waluigi news. But Luigi does get a companion in this game named Gooigi, and he is made of goo, and he can be splatted out of his vacuum, Luigi's vacuum, and sent on mini missions. And it is wildly entertaining. So I highly recommend a late night game, Luigi's Mansion 3. Now, David, you watched 1,000 movies. Can you? Bow, bow, how are you going to do this in a quick way?
We're not. Everyone settle in for a 2-hour bonus.
My lunacy, people. My lunacy.
Just to start on the video game front, I've been a game that you can all, if you have an iPhone, which I hesitate to say most people do, Apple, it's ruining the world. But if you have an iPhone, you can get, it's called Telling Lies. It's something that I think would be of interest to this podcast, to all members of this podcast.
Logan Marshall Green is in that, isn't he?
Logan Marshall Green, Carrie Bish, some other people. But it is, it's a game by Sam Barlow who had a game a few years ago called Her Story. And it's essentially like,
you guys got me to play that. And then I got,
It's like, this is like Her Story on crazy steroids. It's a much bigger production, but it's the same kind of deal. You get an interface, like a screen, you're like using somebody else's computer screen, and you have access to this database of FBI videos, and all you have is a word search. And every time you type in a word, a keyword, videos from the database where that word was said come up, but only if you only have access to 5 at a time. So otherwise you'd have to be more specific. And then you watch the live action video that is contained in all those clips. It's a story about an FBI agent played by Logan Marshall Green and his wife and this other girl he meets and someone else who I'm still not sure yet. And it's completely nonlinear, and you piece together the mystery of, I mean, first of all, you have to figure out what the mystery even is. And like, I know what happened to some of the characters now, but not necessarily what it means or why it's important or what one had to do with the other. It's a really fascinating experience. It is a little bit creepy in its own way, kind of like Her Story was, but I think that has been my fun late night video game treat. But I watched a lot of movies over break. I finally sat down on my couch, which I never do, even though I have all these movies in my apartment, and watched some Blu-rays. I got into the Criterion Channel and whatever was on iTunes a bunch. I watched a whole, sitting there with my baby as he slept until like 3 a.m, so I can make sure that if he cried, I didn't wake my wife up while she desperately needed her little window of sleep. We watched a whole lot of movies about Americans who feel trapped in their lives and just picking everything up and saying, fuck it, and going across the country.
So you watched Under the Tuscan Sun?
We did not. I have that movie memorized. No need to rewatch it, but I'll show it to Asa one day when he's good and ready. We watched Lost in America by Albert Brooks. We watched Wanda. We watched Alice Doesn't Live Here Anymore, which of the 30 movies I watched over the break was maybe my favorite. What a great movie.
And no one talks about it. No one talks about it when they talk about Scorsese.
It's so good. And like
they made it to a TV show. That's how good it was.
Yeah. Well, Major Greta Gerwig energy. I mean, the same sort of like the frantic clip and the way that it's like sort of the sentimentality that's shown about it and how smart it is and still at that pace reminded me a lot of her films. So of course I watched Little Women like 6 times over break, but listen, they're there. We watched Patches. We're going to jump back around to this at the very end of the segment. I'll get to one movie that I want to talk to with you in particular, but I watched Wim Wenders Until the End of the World, Desert Hearts, a lot of movies like that. Got into some 70s and 80s American stuff, Hardcore, A New Leaf, Escape Room from 2019, which just looking over the movies I watched over break, I'd say was, if I had to compare it to another one, was more satisfying than 1917 in every possible way. And so shamelessly sets up a sequel that I am now very eager to see this August.
Comes out this year.
The movie cost $5 million. It made like almost $200 million. So yes, this August is about
There's another Cube. There's a successor to Cube.
Yep. I mean, this movie is so cute.
I'm so happy.
I really hope that Escape Room 2 is not the Hypercube of its franchise.
I was about to joke that it should be called Hyper Escape Room. Yeah, that would be a banger.
I loved The Swimmer. What a beguiling, strange
movie. Oh, my God. Wait, where did you watch that? Did you have to rent that?
The Swimmer is on Criterion. No, The Swimmer is on Criterion Channel now.
Boy, that's an immediate – if you love Mad Men, you really should see this film.
Oh, boy, yeah. I mean, I was describing it on Twitter. It's like it feels like the hallucinatory dream that Don Draper might have on his deathbed.
For people who have never seen it, it is about Burt Lancaster swimming in different people's pools over the course of a day.
But it is
very good.
I watched an Ida Lupino film called The Bigamist, which was fascinating. Midnight Run, De Niro, so good, so hot. I know David Sims talks about this all the time, friend of the show, but true. Anyway, I made a whole letterbox list you can see. But Patches, the one movie I want to talk to you about with you really quickly is Downhill Racer. Downhill oh, yeah. Racer, a Robert Redford vehicle by Michael Richards.
That people don't talk about. It's on Amazon Prime now. People can stream this film right now.
It's not consigned to oblivion. I mean, it is part of the Criterion canon, but it reminded me a lot of the Anton Corbin, George Clooney movie, The American. It's that same sort of like cold, mechanical approach to something. In this case, not an assassin, but a skier. And it may be the most...
And a great skier. Someone too good to be around other humans.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's like... It's the least sentimental sports movie I think I have ever seen. That is sort of the point of the movie up until its truly harrowing final images, which expose a coldness that the, you know, snowy environments of the movie can't hope to compete with. I just thought that the style of Michael Richards' direction was so grabbing, so arresting from the start. I just loved how emotionally inert it was and how the movie does nothing to sort of push against its protagonist's barren storages of empathy. Fascinating movie.
It's also beautiful. The actual shot, like the actual skiing is quite beautiful, I find, at certain times.
Yeah.
I'm trying to think of another movie with skiing in it that makes that sport look as beautiful and majestic as it does say on the Olympics.
I wonder how much of it was
it's a great
Robert
sports film.
Redford. Because, you know, if this is the other part of the half of like a Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid, this gate that gave us the Sundance Film Festival, if how competent of a skier was Robert Redford in his prime?
Apparently parts of the film are shot in Sundance in Utah. So I would imagine that he does a bunch of skiing.
I mean, most of it, whether the vibe that I really liked is that most of the movie is, there is an American detour, but most of the movie is shot in Europe and sort of like the European skiing circuit. And it kind of feels like it's just adjacent to a James Bond movie. Great movie. Anyway, thank you for letting me run long in this segment. I literally said, well, they don't tell you what neither of the people on this podcast who had kids told me. Is that when you have a kid, as soon as you like tweet anything or Instagram or whatever, people are like, go spend time with your kid. Clearly those people have never had newborns.
You're just sitting on the couch. That kid doesn't care if you're on your phone.
You are, I mean, the impulse to not just be on social media all the time because it's 3 a.m. You're the only person awake. You have nothing to do, but you can't stand up. And so you're like, you're just stuck on the couch with this unconscious
Your Times crossword
beam.
Puzzle app, I'm telling you.
Patches, I try to do the New York Times crossword puzzle every day. I fail miserably.
No, but here's what you got. The app gives you the mini puzzles. It's all about the mini puzzles.
Oh, sure.
You can do them endlessly.
I also really like – okay, my bone to pick there, though, is I really love the New York Times Spelling Bee app because Boggle was sort of always my forte. But there isn't an app. I just said there was an app. I was lying to you. There isn't an app. You have to go on NewYorkTimes.com and find and log in. It's a huge pain in the ass. Why isn't there a Spelling Bee app? If Dean Backwet or whatever the Backhay or whatever the fuck runs the New York Times is listening right now, give me a Spelling Bee app. I'm sorry about the segment. Let's move on.
Fighting in the War Room, the most relatable podcast out there. We're nagging the New York Times.
I mean, Dean McKett listens, right?
You're going to believe me now, though.
Yes, sir.
Come here, girl.
Come here, girl.
Let me prepare your world. Let me see the backside of your moon. No Vicky's, only the pearls. Let me take you to Indonesia.
Wow, I guess Dave and I have to fight about the Oscars now.
Yeah. The Oscars.
All right, David, make your case.
Okay.
Dude.
So I
sorry, isn't that like a,
hearing,
isn't
like,
that
Judge Judy
TV
music,
judge?
Music?
I think so, yeah.
Yeah, it's close. I got what you're going for. I can name that tune in two notes. So I was thinking, as I spend too much time doing, about ways to improve the Oscars. It's the time of the year that we think that the Oscar, as we record this, the Oscar nominations are coming out tomorrow morning. So we don't know how terrible they will be, but we can assume that at least in one capacity or another, or probably several, they will be terrible as they usually are.
Do you think Todd Phillips directing Joker is terrible?
What's that? Todd Phillips? if Todd Phillips gets the best director nomination, woof. I was trying to think outside the box a little bit, and one idea I hit upon is that the Oscars should have a critics a wing of a, they should have a branch. Sorry, a branch is the word I'm looking for. I have baby brain. They should have a branch of critics. They should have critics who are part of the Academy. Not very many, as if there are not very many of any branch other than acting, but a few critics to contribute to the nominations. I understand that in the Academy, only the people from each branch vote on their category, and then everybody votes for Best Picture. That is a conundrum I have yet to work out, and if critics were a part of it, but I think to have a handful of elite critics for one reason and one reason only, you know, other than beyond the fact that this is not unprecedented in the Academy, that they have people who don't contribute to the movies directly as members of the Academy in voting. There is a publicist branch, for example. We are part of the holistic community of people who make and contribute to movies and recycle them in our culture and give them oxygen and continue them. But the problem is that despite the Academy's strides to change the complexion of the membership of the Academy, they have made it younger, they have made it more international, they made it more diverse in other ways as well. There's one problem that it doesn't matter how young necessarily or from where they come from or what they look like, these new members have, is that they don't watch everything. They don't have the same compulsion, the same obligation that critics do to really take seriously what this organization is doing at the, its, you know, reason for existing at the end of the year. And critics see everything. They are a little bit more divorced from the idea of just voting for their friends. And they make it their business to be well-versed about everything. And I think, especially at the nomination stage, to help try to normalize the idea that more artistically challenging movies that didn't necessarily, I mean, yes, it's not a given anymore that blockbusters are going to fill up the 10, potentially 10 nominees. And every time we do get some movies that made money in there, everyone is very happy. But I do think that time and again, you have movies that are sort of in the center of this Venn diagram between industry affection and the appearance of critical reception. Your Jojo Rabbits, for example, who are sort of spirited in there at the expense of far more interesting movies that could really serve the Academy, their mission, and also have the Oscars do what they really need to do for the business, which is drive attention to these movies. I think that I can see no reason why critics would not be of service to the Oscars in their current form. But when I proposed this idea to Katie, she was irate. So I'm really curious to hear why.
Because the critics pretty much already do the things that you're talking about with the Critics Awards that many of us vote in and time and again have been shown to have an impact in various awards races. If Lupita Nyong'o gets a Best Actress nomination this year, I think you could very much credit it to the New York Film Critics Circle among one of many examples. Critics have a chance to give out a ton of awards. They're driving a conversation. They're championing things. It doesn't always work. It's infuriating when you have movies or performances that are beloved by critics and people who have seen all the movies and, like, as you said, David, have the time to watch all of these and get ignored. But I think if you threw in 50 critics in a critics branch in the Academy or whatever size it would be,
50 then
throw their votes in against, like, all, I mean, it would just be a drop in the bucket of the Academy. So you would have critics who were thrown into this group where many of the people in it are skeptical of critics and their work, like whether or not they actually should be. And so then if something they don't like gets nominated, they get to blame it on the critics. And then the critics probably won't be able to take credit for any changes because it's such a small number in the thousands of people who are in the Academy.
I agree that practically it wouldn't do all that much good, but I do think that in spirit it is the right move. I would also counter your point about there being other critic awards, that every branch of the Academy has their own award show. There are the SAGs, sure, and the DGAs, and the Oscars are really the show of shows, and I think that the critical interest is not suspended after the New York Film Critics and Los Angeles Film Critics and the Critics' Choice Awards, I guess. It is all pooling into this one award show that I think would be better served to represent the full scope of the industry, particularly when, as self-serving as this whole proposition is, particularly when you're dealing with a group of people who actually, care about this and, like, really want to vet the process. I think that there's some merit to the idea of the Academy just reflecting the artisans involved, but if that's not the mission they're going to have, then I think it's a discussion worth having. Even if,
I mean,
like,
also
so many
the Academy
of the
is an industry I mean, you pointed out the publicists are voters and that also critics are part of the film community. But like the Academy is an industry organization. It's a bunch of people who make
critics
movies.
Are not part of and the filmmaking industry.
Yeah. I mean,
publicists are.
Like, yeah, exactly. Like publicists, like they can be unit publicists. Like they can be there as part of the film being made. They can be like representing the filmmakers the whole time.
That's absolutely
critics you are do, just you aren't part visits. Of that ecosystem in the same
oh,
way.
Oh, God.
Yeah.
No,
yeah that, okay, great.
That is not an argument working in your favor.
You know, I've never done this episode in my life.
Wait, a critic could be a hack. A hack. We could praise.
Yes. But I would say that they should be. And I think that, you know, your point is very well taken about it being a drop in the bucket in the Academy membership, in part because of the positive strides they've made to grow their numbers.
Yeah.
But I do think that...
why would critics want to be part of it? Why do you want to...
Why wouldn't they want to be?
Because you want to stand against this organization and criticize them and do what you do as a critic. To be part of this body would connect you to something that you need to stand on the outside of as part of your job, as part of your perspective, to become part of what you are critiquing and the culture of the Oscars themselves or what they choose versus what you would choose. It seems to be the opposite.
You don't think
of what
that anybody in the film industry proper has been critical of the Oscars or takes it as their mission to be critical of the Oscars? I mean, like it's not as if you would be biting the hand that feeds you or you would have a conflict of interest.
No,
I think it would only give you more of a leg to stand on.
Those are two different things. And I think the latter, you would have a conflict of interest.
I disagree. I think that we are most critical. I mean, film critics in particular are most critical of and engaged in the things that involve them directly. You know, this is a pipe dream. It's a thought that I'm just throwing out there.
You got to campaign, man. You got to get out there and make the change.
But I think that there are ways to continue to improve the Academy Awards, and with some blue sky ideas, why not?
Critics already have a lot of room to weigh in on the awards race. I don't know that they need more.
This podcast,
but if anyone wants to make me an Academy member,
there it is.
Welcome to. I'll happily accept your invitation. Just don't let David in.
Fine.
Now, what y'all wanna do? Wanna be the year is 1917. The film is 1917. I got nothing else.
There's one shot. You got one shot. Don't throw it away. You get one.
That's what
shot.
The one in 1917
Patches,
stands for.
How do you feel
twice.
About this movie being nominated potentially for the award that it just won, the Critics' Choice Awards for Best Editing?
Well, as I said, you the twist at the end there. yeah, I can't defend the Critics' Choice Awards, the awards group that some of us actually are a part of. That's a tough one. I'm not sure what. Anyone who voted for that, and the majority, I guess, of people who voted for that are thinking in Sam Mendes' new film, which is uniquely, but extravagantly poised to be a single-shot movie. It's taking us from the trenches of the British troops through no man's land across German territory and trying to get to another British camp to save a battalion that's about to charge directly into a German ambush. Can they do it in time? Tick, 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 tick. It's all one shot. We only have one night to get there. Let's do it. No cuts, quote unquote. It's all invisible trickery, thanks to Roger Deakins, renowned cinematographer. He's back, baby, shooting the shit with his boy Mendes and making something that Sam Mendes says is a testament to his grandfather who served in World War I, who he watched wash his hands every day. And he always wondered, why did his grandfather wash his hands? It's because he felt the pain of war every day in his life. Now, that's probably true. I don't want to knock Sam Mendes' grandfather who served in World War I. I'm certainly not in a position to do that. It's a pretty sappy story the way Sam Mendes tells it as the intro to every goddamn screening of 1917, but it's going to serve him well in award season. This one's going all the way. I told Katie and Dave and our friend Joanna Robinson this way back in early November. No one believed me. But this is the full package. This is the real deal.
Wait, you think it's going to win Best Picture?
Oh, I think it's going to win Best Picture. Oh, it's going to win Best Picture.
Once Upon a Time in Hollywood is going to win Best Picture.
No way. It's going to win. 1917 is going to win Best Picture. It's just it's checking all the boxes, right? It's got a bunch of famous British faces who give momentary performances. I was going to qualify them, but I'll get to my actual thought on this movie at the end of this conversation. It's got Sam Mendes just campaigning like a madman and having so much to say about his history and World War One on film. And it's got Roger Deakins, the great cinematographer of our time, just doing this extravagant stunt, this magic trick. It's a real action movie. You walk out of the theater, at least people at the DGA premiere screening that I went to, where everyone's just like blown back into their seats. They don't even know what to think because this is a relentless movie. This is a Michael Bay movie. And here's the real twist. And I think we'll have a lot to talk about here because some of us like it and some of us don't. This movie sucks. Okay. Yeah. 1917 is a real spit in the face of, wartime stories. I was actually, by the end of it, having heard Sam Mendes talk about the importance of his grandfather serving in the war and the chaos of this experience, you know, World War One and World War Two, so different. There aren't clear cut enemies in this war. They're like, boys went to war and they didn't know why. And people, the Germans and the British, like, who, you're just serving in this war and there's such devastation. Yeah, personal stories that they bring back to your families and you tell through generation to generation, they do matter. They're so meaningful and those experiences are hard for people to talk about and they should be put on film so the next generation can learn about them. And 1917 ain't that movie, man. I thought it was actually insulting how stupid and action driven this movie is, how it's all about spectacle and how it's all about blowing stuff up and having a one single shot that really doesn't make anything more interesting. I don't understand the conceit of either the technical or the kind of tropey. We're going to kind of roll every single war story into a single 90 minute or 2 hour run across no man's land. It just didn't compute for me on any level. And this movie makes me so angry, and I still think it's going to win Best Picture.
Why do you think it's insulting? I don't understand. Because it's no one person's story. Because it's not a real person's story?
Not because it's not a real person's story. It just is not character-driven at all. It's not. It didn't feel like it had any one person's perspective. It felt like we have to get to every kind of beat in a war movie. We have to see a shootout in a wasted away city. We have to see plane crashes. We have to see trench battles. We have to get to every single moment that we might see in individual specific war movies, or it felt like every single diary mashed together, as opposed to what's one person's experience? How are they seeing this nonsensical war? Or what is the brutality like? And how can trench warfare from followed behind someone's head and weaving through these encampments, like, what is that like? I couldn't become immersed in any second of this movie. I thought it was quite astonishing how removed I felt from the whole thing when the idea of it is to be fully immersed. Like, I couldn't attach myself to any character.
I think you get that from the vignettes that he's finding his way through. You've got George MacKay, who's like sort of this everyman character. He's a little bit more of like the grizzled war veteran of the pair of these people who we see start out in the beginning of the movie. And I think he does emerge as a character over the course of what you're seeing. And then he has these encounters with these other soldiers in the back of a truck or with this, French woman, German, where are they? Poland?
I don't know where the woman he interacts with once.
And the forest full of soldiers who are praying before they go into battle, or like all of the stars who show up as the various leaders who he's kind of running into, who, like, I think a lot of people felt like it took them out of the movie. I really enjoyed this kind of like pop over visit to people who are more familiar faces. I feel like you do get this holistic picture of the landscape of what this war was. And I mean, I know that you never stopped thinking about the gimmick. Like, it is drawing attention to itself at every moment, but it did draw me into the movie the way that it was working. I know that Dunkirk exists. I think Dunkirk's a better movie. Oh, I still like 1917.
Such a better movie. But yeah, I didn't find myself necessarily thinking about the gimmick the whole time. Certainly in the beginning and at its most video gamey. And obviously working at Polygon for a year and a half has changed my perspective, probably. I'm thinking more about games. But this really is the most video game movie that I've seen in many years, to the point
where
I
like this more because I don't play video games.
I don't, maybe, and it inches you towards something that's like the experience of playing video games, and it feels successful in what it's doing, trying to have that relentless pace, or but feel the full scope of a world where you, every step you take, you know, you have to take that step. That you, there's no cutting, right? They have to cross long stretches of earth, scorched earth, to get the places where they're going. And maybe you felt every step that way. But when they're in the trenches, for instance, or they enter a German trench underground, and some explosions go off, or some bombs, and the whole place is caving in. I think one of them guys is literally like, "Hey, man, come on, this way." And then they run, and they're like, "Oh, stop, we gotta jump. 3, 2, 1, let's go." And it's, and the dialogue felt like cutscenes or something. It was so peculiar to me.
See,
and
that doesn't mean anything to me.
No, I know. So I'm coming at this from a certain perspective, but I think I'm also coming at from a mainstream perspective where a lot of people might have that same problem. But yeah, I don't know. This movie was not working for me. I wanted to. There aren't a lot of World War I movies out there, and there aren't a lot of accounts that could make me truly understand the horrors of trench warfare. But I just felt so removed from it, especially at the end, this culminating moment where he's like outrunning bombs. It's so Hollywood.
I mean, that's like that moment that you've seen in the trailer. That is basically what you see in the trailer. The culminating moment comes later when, you know, famous actor who maybe we don't need to name, yeah, like shows up at the end and like brings the emotional climax of the entire film. Like, I think it's careful that it understands that it's like giving you spectacle in a lot of different ways, but comes back to a story that's about actual human beings.
I don't know the last time I've seen a movie that built to a bigger moment of that's it. I was so like the air. Oh, this movie is really. No, this movie is very bad. I'm completely with Patches. I was so deflated by the ending. I will admit that I was supposed to see this movie on the day that my son was born. I was about halfway out the door to a screening when Elisa went into labor, and so that took a backseat, much as I love, I don't know what I can pull out to make fun of Sam Mendes right now, but he did really burn me on Spectre, a movie that, like, actually hurt. Yeah, it really does. But, I watched the movie on DVD at home, and I watched half of it and was so bored that I turned it off, and then it started winning these awards, and I ended up watching the other half like a couple weeks later.
You created the cut in the one shot. Destroyed the illusion.
I wish that I created
there
the
is a
one
cut.
Shot.
There's but one Sam cut already Mendes, built into this, it. Is that yeah, I mean, you turn it off?
Well, no, but Katie, I mean, that's exactly, that's not the long and short of why this movie doesn't work, but it does speak to how poorly the approach to it technically serves the story. Because why would you tell a story in this way when you are going a completely fictional story, you know, fictional enough anyway, other than what his grandfather may have told him, that you can manipulate in any way you see fit and build a huge cut into 2/3 into the movie that skips time ahead 12 hours. Like it completely.
So Roger Deakins can film a night scene.
I mean, but what a terrible night scene. I mean, it looks like hell on earth, which is great. Happy for Roger Deakins for completely wasting his talents on this movie. But it's like such a dramatically inert sequence of events. The scene with the French girl is gobsmackingly off.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, the whole point, the only.
It's a joke. That scene where he gets milk early in the movie. It's like a payoff. It's a weird gag. It's so strange.
The only way that this technique could serve the story is to sort of impress upon you. And you talk about like the time image and these long takes and what they are able to connote that more traditional editing cannot is the passage of time. And so something that I was interested in from the start was the idea that so little time elapsed from when he and his friend, these two guys, were just sitting around waiting for something to happen, and when they were fucking like neck deep in a video game tutorial in a bunker, looking at all these exploding things. Like, that was the dumbest scene. One of the dumber scenes, I should say, because we already talked about the dumbest scene. But the idea that like life is great, war is so insane that those two planes of existence could be so close to one another. And the movie perverts that idea at every possible turn. Does feel so incredibly over the top. It's like now there's a plane crashing here, and this guy's dead, and this thing is collapsing, and there's a sniper here, and there's this. I mean, it's just like, it all feels so implausible. It does. It's so poorly serves the story that you are constantly being thrown back at the means of its own creation. The making of this movie is such a better film than the movie itself.
Yeah.
Watching the behind the scenes stuff is fascinating.
They're astonishing.
The movie itself is a total chore. God have mercy on everyone involved and who liked it. May you all rot in hell. But I do think that I am happy. I am happy that the movie is making money. I'm not going to be happy if it wins any awards, but I am happy that it's making money. I think it's always a good thing in this day and age, however sad this might be. I've said this before on the podcast, when an original movie, particularly one as expensive as this, is able to sweep up at the box office, and I think awards are there to make this possible. And so I'm glad Universal's going to need it after Doolittle comes out, I'm sure. But in the same weekend, you had something like Underwater, which is a genuinely fun movie. Kristen Stewart battling sea monsters. What could go wrong? Spoiler alert, TJ Miller gets eaten alive from inside a suit by a sea monster. I mean, this is what you want to pay your money for, people. Monster on monster action. But that movie bombed this weekend. That should be nominated for Best Picture so people actually turn out to see it.
Dave, will you save the limping Katie, who's been shot by snipers here. She's limping through no man's land.
I'm sorry you guys can't enjoy things that are good and interesting.
Damn, we just got fans versus critics. Dave?
Love World War One. Big fan.
I don't think it's bad, but it's more like weird flex, okay? It's like they got spoiled doing James Bond together, and we're just like, we could do all these cool things. And then threw it into a context where that's not the context where I want to see cool things. Like, what really would have helped this movie was cuts. I would have been less curious about how he got certain places and less actively trying to look for seams because I was in a patch of watching nothing. In which case, I know that they're hiding a cut somewhere. And it's really like weird choices that draw you technically into, I mean, that draw you into technically engaging with the film when you should be emotionally engaging with the film. Like, it starts visually where it just doesn't show you the thing that you like want to see, whether it be like a flare that's turned into like a background element, or like the weird sequence where he's processing a death. And therefore, we're supposed to kind of forget this weird Jeep trail that they're traveling an undetermined amount of time through mud through. And I know these things shouldn't be important, but because the film decides to take us through or attempt to do something like real time to anchor us to the characters, instead what happens is there are long periods of time where I'm wondering why this is shot this particular way. I'm not necessarily like in the character's head. It's a weird example where show not tell is not working for me necessarily because what I'm being shown is a magic trick that is inherently based around people who have seen war cinema before. So because I've, seen Saving Private Ryan and whatnot, I'm used to a camera reacting to explosions or focusing on somebody's kicking legs when it should be focusing on their face or making these decisions that we've associated with war cinema, and to take it and to do it with like a prestige style, which is like, we're going to do this so artfully with this like drifting, swirling camera that you're not going to be able to tell where the cuts are. It grates on me. So, like, the nighttime sequence is actually one of the things that didn't grate on me because it's shot so starkly that it makes you completely pull out of the movie to a certain degree, where I guess that's where the character's the most like the audience, because he's just bleeding out of the head and has no idea where he is or where he's going. He just needs to, you know, run for his life. At that point, you're able to just, like, settle in and enjoy how it's shot. Which otherwise,
I mean, that part is enjoyable, but it also turns into a just a straight Bond movie. I thought suddenly this guy can like have stealth moves and kill Germans, and he's a super soldier. And I mean, it's just a strange sequence after these guys were supposed to seem so feeble, and like David Goliath story. Suddenly, this guy is just taking out goons by jumping from the shadows. I don't know. I just that really turned me off when I started thinking about it.
It's pretty tame in terms of like the threat of immediate violence. Like the one like meaningful death that we get like one third of the way through the film, we don't even see the actual wound being whatever. We turn around to get the shock of it happening, but because of that, there's this sort of idea that as long as he's on camera, he's safe. Like as long as we're watching him, he's the hero. And the movie sort of like replaces that for character development, because we don't really get the most key part about his character until the last shot. I'm sorry, it's all one shot. The last part of the one shot of the movie.
That's right.
But it's hinted at before that. Like you get,
oh yeah,
you're invited to speculate about who he is and what his life is like.
Yeah, but I feel like also if I would have known that from the beginning, I could have maybe invested in him a little bit more than his position at the beginning, where he's like, I don't even want to go home. And you're like, well, why? And like, you don't get to the point where it's like, because it's like too hard until we're far into the adventure and like post rat setting off Resident Evil 2 traps. So it's just, it's, if Sam Mendes wants to make this movie and he wants to make it with Roger Deakins, like, awesome, but like, shoot it like this type of movie should, like, go, you know, go All Quiet on the Western Front or something and go for some fucking compositions that aren't based around this is the chain link between these two things we really want to do. Because then you end with stuff like it goes low around a rock and you're like, is this rock important? And by the time you're back on the characters, you've already spent 5 seconds wondering if the rock was
a good
important.
Rock. I just want to, I mean, we can start wrapping this up too. We've done this all in one shot, so it's pretty spectacular. Two things. One, Andrew Scott is really good in the movie.
So good.
He shows up for 5 minutes and starts just screaming, and telling them how stupid they are for wanting to go on to
No Man's Land. He's so pissed about being in World War I, and you get it.
Great character. Would have liked either more of that or just more vignettes with different characters. I mean, I know that they're on
more
a mission.
Vignettes would have been great. Because even Mark Strong is like, oh, he's there. Mark Strong. We're going to get some Mark Strong stuff. Yeah. And then it's like, oh, nope.
There might be now a talkier version of 1917 that's good. I think when it blew itself up into a Michael Bay movie is when I got the most pissed off. And then, Katie, my second thing is a question for you, which is...
When you're comparing it to a Michael Bay movie, Michael Bay movies are famous for the amount of cuts in them. That's driving me crazy. It's so nothing like a Michael Bay movie.
Okay, it's a stunt show.
Wait, Katie...
It's the opening scene of Six Underground.
You can absolutely call it a stunt show.
Katie and Patches and Dave, please answer the question I posed at the beginning of the segment.
Which was...
You don't remember, it wasn't that memorable. It didn't burrow into your soul and make you rethink your relationship to this in all movies. I asked if 1917 should be nominated for the award that it just won.
Best editing.
The Oscars.
Best editing?
No.
Just one of the critic choices.
No.
No, it should not. Uncut Gem should be nominated.
That's what I voted for.
Really?
No, because when you make a movie like that, you plan every single cut so far in advance. The editor must be part of all of this, but... No.
Yeah, no.
But I mean, that's not the... I mean, you know, Bong Joon-ho.
Wait, wasn't there another movie where you actually were a big
fan? Yes, Birdman. No, yeah. I wasn't a big fan of it. I was waging the same argument.
Right, I recall this now. And I'm having bad memories of Birdman again. Thank you.
Yeah, Birdman was winning precursor awards for best editing, and I believe did not get Oscar nomination, ultimately.
It did not get an Oscar nomination.
Did you know that Inarritu wanted to do The Revenant as one shot?
I read about that on IndieWire.com this week. Yeah.
That's dumb.
Okay. Yeah, I mean, listen, that came from, like, I'm not saying that DiCaprio has that information wrong, but listening to him talk on Marc Maron, where that tidbit came from,
yes.
He was sort of making clear that he had no idea what happened in a couple of the movies he was in. So,
no, I mean, The Revenant is shot in a way that I totally believe that and could see.
Yes,
in a
yes.
Yeah, The Revenant, Birdman, The Revenant and 1917 have similar vibes.
Yes.
I also liked The Revenant. So,
but my question for you, Katie, to wrap this up was, you know, we talked about being really aware of the one shot gimmick or the style. I should be nicer. When did it really work for you? What was a moment in the film where you felt like the technical and the emotional was kind of feeling cohesive and working in tandem?
I mean, I think probably when they're early in the movie, when they're going through the trenches and you're kind of you know, they go through and they get their assignment, and then they go through the trench to get to the next phase to try to get out of there and eventually run into Andrew Scott. And I'm thinking about how they are navigating this incredibly large constructed world, and also thinking about how many versions of the trench did they shoot or did they build, and then they cut, and then they have to like redress that part of the trench to like go to another part of it. But it all kind of works together for the folly of war and how much human effort it takes to launch a war and how much folly and human effort it takes to film a movie like this. I don't know that that's what they intended, but they worked really well.
How much folly and effort does it take to praise a movie like this, Katie? That's the real question.
I really didn't think about how my liking this is like my liking The Revenant until you brought it up. And like at the end when he like, you know, he encounters this like field full of young men kind of singing or listening to a pastor sing, I can't remember. And you're just kind of watching the camera swoop among them and like pausing to be in the space where they are and like kind of pausing with this character who's exhausted and feeling his exhaustion along with that. Like it didn't really not work for me at any point. Like I noticed the cuts the way that Dave did, but it didn't bother me. It kind of felt like part of experiencing it as part of it, experiencing how it was to make it.
Yeah.
And that felt like part of the story.
I was just trying to push more for like when it did work or when you felt where it felt like the experiment made sense for this movie. You were just describing the scenes in the trenches, which I do think are effective. And I think I'm trying to think of movies that masquerade as one shot or actually are one shot. And like something like Rope, I think really works well because we're confined to a very small space and it's very theatrical and play-like. And I could imagine a version of 1917, basically it could be any World War I movie, that just takes place entirely in the trenches and you feel the claustrophobia and you feel the running back and forth, trying to get through the men, trying to get one place to the other. And like, now I understand why the one shot approach would make sense. You're telling this kind of talkie drama where characters have to take every single step and push their way through to get things done. And maybe you go over the trench at some point, but like confined spaces seem to make a lot more sense for one shot. And doing it like this, I'm not sure I understand the payoff of this artistic approach at any point in the movie where it's like, ah, yes, we've been building to this shot or this moment. Maybe it is
when he sits down next to a tree.
Yeah, maybe it is when he sits down among the men.
Next to a tree, David. Doesn't that sound nice? That
sounds beautiful.
That's another Hamilton reference we could spin it back to if you want to continue on with the one shot thing.
Didn't understand.
But let's never speak of this movie again until we have to every day for the next couple weeks. Isn't this beautiful, shortened Oscar season such a wonderful thing? How great is it?
What are you talking about? Yeah, wait until, I don't know if you have to work award shows, but when the SAG Awards and the Grammys are on the same night, you tell me how you feel about it.
How can the stars be all in one place?
It's going
to be. It is truly amazing to, and Katie, that is an article that I would read on Vanity Fair.
About what like, I did during the SAG. No,
it's like a Mrs. Doubtfire date.
No, not at all. I was talking about like Bong Joon-ho's travel schedule over the last month.
was the Lion King nominated for an ensemble award? Beyonce will have to be at the Grammys and the SAG Awards all in one night. What a wild ride.
The Grammys?
It should be done in one shot.
The Grammys?
A single shot.
I do not think she's going to be at both. Anyway, no, I really miss longer Oscar season. This one's driving me crazy. I mean, David, you talk about how Oscar voters don't have enough time to see the movies. Think of how little time they have to even see what
they should
nominated.
Make it more of a priority. They had Christmas break. Come on. But I think I'd be curious, you know, it's just like life before pregnancy. You forget, like if you could remember how sick of all of this you are come like the first weekend of March back when the Oscars were when they used to be. I think
the Oscar used to be at the end of March, which is psychotic.
I mean, that is truly beyond the pale. And that is
they should make ridiculous. A film where we really capture the horrors of Oscar season. All one shot, I think. they really feel the every step.
Matt
Patch
is trying
March.
To walk up a flight of stairs in his free Netflix Pope shoes.
It's scary. You don't know what's going to happen.
I've been drinking my Charlize Theron wine tonight on behalf of
That was good. I drank
this
it when I watched Bombshell and did not make Bombshell any better. The Marriage Story, I said this before we started recording, I think, the Marriage Story blanket that I'm still trying to wrap my head around why that was related to the movie, comforting like Marriage Story is. My newborn child literally spent most of his first month on this planet wrapped up inside. And so to Netflix, I say thank you.
Ayo. You ready? Let's do it.
That does it for this week's Fighting in the War Room. We'll be back next week. The Oscar nominations will be out by then, so I don't know. 1917 is being nominated, so it's not like anything's going to change. In the meantime, tell the people who you are.
I'm Matt Patches, senior editor at Polygon.com. I'm on Twitter at Mr. Patches, but trying to look at Twitter links, so don't at me. And we have a website, fightinginthewarroom.com. That's my new social media platform. I'm just in the comments all the time, just talking to you guys. It's getting so real in 2020.
I'm David Ehrlich. Thank you so much for letting me go hog wild on this episode, even more so than usual. I had a lot of pent up talking to do after the last six weeks.
Never let you go again.
I'll try. I'm sure some of our listeners are going to be sad to even say that, but I will try to pen it going forward. I am the senior film critic for IndieWire. You can find me on Twitter at David Ehrlich. You can find all of us together on iTunes, Fighting in the War Room. Please leave us a review. We will read it exactly as you write it on the show. And Death to 1917.
Wow.
I'm Dave Gonzalez, but my first name, DA7E. That's also my Twitter handle. You can also find me on The Storm, a Lost rewatch podcast, where we are rewatching the ABC series Lost. We're back on the island midway through season 2. It's a nice thing to, like, go back and do weekly watches of television shows. I think that's something that Katie sort of hinted at with the Mandalorian. But
yeah.
Yay non-bingeable content. Or yay not binging, possibly bingeable content. You can find that wherever podcasts are distributed.
I'm Katie Rich. You can find me at VanityFair.com and on the Little Goldman podcast, where we will have an Oscar nominations episode. You can hear all the freaking out from there. And I'll be talking to fellow 1917 fan Joanna Robinson. So you guys like her more than all the rest of us combined. So join my team. You can find me on Twitter at Katie Rich and all of us at FITWR, where you can talk to us about all kinds of things or answer this week's lightning round question, which was...
In honor of Bad Boys for Life, what other P. Diddy song should become a movie?
Thank you for listening, and we'll be back talking to you next week.
This is Bad Boys for Life. We ain't going nowhere. We ain't going nowhere.
We ain't going nowhere.
We can't stop now. Cause it's Bad Boys for Life.
It ain't shit changed since the Notorious. See, everything's still going.